Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host, Richard Banks, and I have with me tonight a special guest, Philip Loriano, all the way from... Where are you at the moment?
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. Fantastic. So you're not in Australia, and as I was just saying on the bit that I forgot to record before, we do normally only talk to Aussies, but we're making a special exception in your case because you're just so awesome.
Well, I'm honored. Well, and Australia is lucky enough to have two other IOC container authors, so it's good to be among friends.
Or competition. Sure. You know what they say, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right?
It may be, but we always keep an eye out on each other, so it's a very, very small community, and it's always fun to watch what they're doing versus what I might be doing at the time.
So let's just, for those of the audience who don't actually know you by name, they might know some of what you've been doing. So do you want to have a bit of a run through some of the things you do and what you do to keep yourself busy during the day?
Well, during the day, I'm just your regular senior developer working at an investment bank in Hong Kong. And during my night hours, I usually geek out on IOC containers or IL rewriting. And some of my work is pretty well known. If you use in Hibernate, currently there are two proxy factories. The first one is Linfu. The other one would be Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from the proxy generators, I'm also an IOC container author. I think there are other authors such as Nick Blumhart.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is Christoph.
Yep.
But technically, it's actually Hammett, but I think he just passed the torch to Christoph for Castle. There's also Glenn Block. Technically, it's not an IOC container, but he's responsible for Meth. The other one is Nate Kohari. He is responsible for Ninject. And the other gentleman, which I met at Oradev, is Jeremy Miller, and he's the guy for Structure Map. So it's less than probably eight guys in the whole community of IOC container authors.
Which is really surprising when you consider just how widely used they are.
Yeah, and I've talked to all of them. They have some very, very different perspectives. Well, one thing that really surprised me through the years is that I've never actually seen any of these authors talk about how they put their containers together. I mean, of course, I went over the podcast for Nick's AutoFact container, and he did talk about all of the features, though. But like a lot of authors, they really don't dig into how they actually put their containers together, which I find interesting, because there's a lot of knowledge to be gained in digging through the source code and seeing the methodology, the styles of coding, and how they go about putting things together. And that's actually one of the things that I do for fun. I mean, on one hand, I write a lot of IL and do a lot of things that people would call magic because it just sounds off. The other hand is that I do a lot of work with IOC containers because it directly affects my job, and it really makes my life easier. So that's pretty much what I do.
Which bit should we talk about first? I'm kind of tempted to talk IOC, but I'm also tempted to talk IL. It might be worth starting there and then just seeing where we head off to. So the IL rewriting, do you want to talk about that in terms of what you're doing with it?
Oh, yeah. Right now, there are two frameworks for actually doing aspect-oriented programming. One of them is PostSharp, which is pretty popular. The other one is Linfu. What I do with Linfu is I can take any assembly. I can look at your instructions. I can change the way your entire assembly works, and I could replace things at runtime. For example, I could replace method calls, I could replace field accesses, I could dynamically intercept thrown exceptions, I could also intercept third-party method calls. For example, if you don't have direct, you can't really change the base class library in the .NET framework, then what you could go ahead and do is at least change the call so it redirects it to something else, and you could change that. And these are the kind of things that I normally do just for fun.
Change parts of how the BCL works.
Yeah. I mean, some people build model airplanes. I'm the one who kind of changes the BCL just for kicks.
So give me an example. Well, in terms of, apart from just getting a wicked sense of fascination and joy out of hacking things for fun, a sense of what you'd be using that sort of approach for in terms of real world or day-to-day development.
Well, in day-to-day development, it comes in handy in cases where you need to do any kind of mocking or isolation, especially when it comes to legacy code and you don't have the source code anymore. One of the nice things about working with assemblies is that even if you don't have the source code anymore, you could always look it up in Reflector or LDASM. But even if you were to look at it and disassemble it, you still really can't change it unless you were to somehow recompile it. And that's the problem that I ran into back in 2003, 2004 with code generators, these text-based code generators like CodeSmith. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was great to be able to generate these apps with a click of a button, but the problem was you can't really round-trip it and change it when you need something. Especially if there was just a slight change, it's either you had to manually go through it, or you basically had to pretty much live with what you got. In this case, with working with IL rewriting, you pretty much cut out the middleman. You're working directly with the structure of the program, and at the same time, the results are much, much more immediate than, say, having to generate the code, recompile, and go through the whole cycle all over again.
So one of the things that that comes to mind in terms of, you know, using IL rewriting to get to testing, for instance, or to deal with, you know, third-party libraries, is that Microsoft's got the MOLS framework. How does that differ or compare to what you're doing with IL rewriting?
Well, I'm not really familiar with what framework was it?
MOLS framework? You know, with PEX. So they've got the PEX library and then MOLS. So MOLS.
I mean, MOLS is actually, I think MOLS actually does that. It's behind the, I mean, I never really got into it though, but basically from what I understand, the idea was to hook into the profiler library, and just before the method goes through the just-in-time compiler, MOLS actually redirects it to another method that you could use as a mock. So basically what they're doing behind the scenes is IL rewriting. I don't know what their terminology is, but that's it. And even more commercial libraries such as TypeMock, what they do is they actually just take your method calls and then redirect it to somewhere else. So in that sense, the principle is the same. I mean, this magic that you see is basically changing the instructions at runtime. Of course, the end user would never really know that because to them it looks like magic, but that's what it happens behind the scenes.
Okay, so in terms of, you mentioned the profiler library. And I know that's how some of these tools work. What's the actual trick that they use?
Well, in the profiler library, it's a little bit more tricky than your standard manage IL rewriting, because what they do, as far as I can remember, is that they put in a hook through the unmanaged CLR profiler API that tells them exactly when a method is about to be translated into native code. And just at that point, before it's translated into native code, they inject their own code. And what that code does is it rewrites the method body. And it's at that point where they can pretty much do whatever they want with it.
That's pretty freaky stuff.
It is freaky stuff. I mean, it's I would say that the Profiler API is a place I don't even go. because I've actively tried to forget Calm, but you know, it's been 10 years and it's still not working.
What, you still haven't forgotten? You're probably not drinking enough.
It sears the mind. That's all I gotta say.
All right, so leaving Profiler alone, because it is pretty scary and it's not quite what we're talking about anyway. Are you rewriting the actual technique that's involved? What actually occurs? So I know of you, some people have used some of the tools in the past, like PostSharp, which basically does a second pass over the code. So it compiles once through Studio and then does a second pass over the app, over the, I suppose, the IL code then at that point. What's the magic that's happening behind the scenes?
Well, what libraries like PostSharp do and what Linfu do is they read the assembly in, and in essence, what it's turning it into is a very, very primitive abstract syntax tree. In fact, this tree that's being read in is just equivalent to maybe a C# 1.0 syntax tree with generic support. A lot of the things that you would see in C# 1.0 are there. The only difference is you have generics and there's some other things that you could do. But for the most part, when it's reading this information in, you take it and put it into a tree, you change the instructions, and then you write it back to disk. And then pretty much once it's written back to disk, you have your compiled assembly. It just seems complicated, but this is no different than if you were to parse a full language, such as maybe C# or even VB.net. But the difference here, I hate saying that. Yeah. One language less readable than IL, I tell you. Anyway, so basically the difference with IL, at least IL rewriting, is that you could basically round trip it. If you change the code, you compile to IL, then you could pretty much change it back into a readable structure without necessarily having to go back to the source language. At the same time, I've done some pretty interesting hacks with IL that it just you would not be able to do if it was just your standard programming language. In many of the cases when I had to do method interception, I could pretty much leave the original code alone, and I just had to do a lot of voodoo with branching instructions to make sure that the original block of code was the same. But for the most part, it worked perfect.
So the only thing then that becomes an issue, I suppose, with doing IL rewriting is if you have to sign your assemblies.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. But even then, there are certain ways around it. I mean, I think you could use IL merge to re-sign it. That's one way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're working with signed assemblies, there is a way you could actually strip or remove the signed assembly from the whatever assembly you're working on so you could modify it. So that's not an issue either. I mean, the only time where you might run into issues is if you're working with a very, very publicly well-known library, like for example, the base class library, where you can't necessarily use an alternate version because obviously everything else is going to be referencing it.
Yep.
So other than that, I mean, it's pretty much open to what you want to do with it. My constant disclaimer is, you know, here are the tools. Please don't shoot yourself with it. I know you're a responsible adult, but be careful.
Okay, so the main use for IL rewriting generally is the AOP or aspect-oriented programming.
That's one of them.
It seems to be the main use that people talk about. But what are some of the other reasons that you'd look to do IL rewriting in the first place, apart from that?
Well, aside from aspect-oriented programming, if you look at this from the bigger picture, what IL rewriting actually is a do-it-yourself compiler. A lot of the things that you would normally have to wait for from the Microsoft team in Redmond, you could probably do on your own by implementing, you know, whatever IL library you decide to create. For example, I was able to implement mixins, duck typing, that sort of thing in C# without even necessarily having to wait for Microsoft. And that's the kind of thing that you can do if you understand the nuances behind working with IL.
So for someone who might just have gone, the what's? The mixins and duck typing, do you want to just run through that quickly as to what they are?
Okay. Mixins are a language feature that comes from languages like Ruby and Python. Actually, the funny thing about the word mixin is it actually comes from ice cream. Because I think it was MIT or some really high-end university came up with the idea of calling it mixins, because you could have different flavors of ice cream and then you could throw them into a bucket and mix them together and they would act as if they're one cohesive piece of ice cream.
Which tastes better.
Which tastes better, supposedly. So when we're talking about mixins and objects, what's really happening there is I could take different parts of different objects, and at runtime, I can combine these objects, and they don't necessarily have to be complete classes. They just have to be different parts of objects, and it would act as if it was always part of that object. So in normal, I mean, plain old classic object-oriented talk, this is basically like being able to change your class definitions at runtime.
So the thing that some people will complain about that having that sort of power leads to is, especially if you're doing it in, say, C#, is that it leads to code that's harder to understand or harder to track down where functionality comes from. It's a similar complaint with AOP in general, that you've got these aspects that are floating around, but where do they come from and how do I track what aspect is tied to what and how it suddenly turned up in my code and so forth. How does do you have a response to that other than
of course. I mean, it's like any other piece of software. I mean, you have to have good solid tests around your code, because even if you put in aspects and you've got a great set of tests to wrap around your existing code, then you're going to see if there's anything wrong once you start putting those aspects in. And you can even put in tests to check whether those aspects exist or not. And it's quite simple to do with at least with Linfoo and the container itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump back to something we were talking about right at the start, IOC containers. So
okay.
What are you doing in terms of your version of a container?
Well, when I wrote Linfoo, I wanted to create something that had all the capabilities of all the other containers, but it was simple enough that you could pick it up in about 5 minutes. So on one hand, if you're an IOC container geek like me, you can look at how it's actually put together and go through the code and understand it. But at the same time, if you're just an average developer who wants to get things done and doesn't want to go through all the code to see how to get it working, then you can just read one of my articles and it's really, really simple. So I wanted the balance between power and usability, and I think over the past few years I managed to hit it. I've never actually had any person ever say, I cannot understand this at all. The other part of this is, like Nick, I didn't want to go through the hell of XML, but at the same time, I didn't want to transfer the hell of XML into code per se and force users to actually configure their container through code, which seemed kind of strange to me, because it's like you're moving the configuration from one form of expression to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So in Linfoo, what I actually did was I said, okay, what's the most minimal amount of configuration that a person has to do in order to actually configure their dependencies? And I think it was like 3 years ago, I settled for using attributes. So basically, if you had a dependency and the dependency was ifoo, you could pretty much use attributes to say that this particular concrete class implements this dependency.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like what Neph does now, but I think I predated them by like 2 or 3 years. So, but it was basically the same idea with imports and exports. But at the same time, all you had to do is put in these attribute declarations and just make one method call against the container, and it would pretty much configure itself with all the components that you needed.
And so that worked by just running a little bit of reflection to have a look at what was there, and then going from there.
Precisely.
Or was it? So this didn't involve this. Was this is separate to the IL rewriting?
Yeah, it is. Actually, Linfu is one of my older projects. I think it was 2009, I actually had another project where I wondered and I asked myself, I mean, is there any way you could rethink the way IOC containers are written? And one of the more interesting projects that I came up with is something I call Hero, which is HIRO, like from the TV show Heroes. And the idea was, is it possible to make the world's fastest container by freezing configuration? Basically, without getting into too many details, Hero is an IOC container compiler framework. What it does is that you give it a list of dependencies, and based on what your dependencies look like, it pretty much compiles a separate assembly, which is basically an IOC container compiled in pure IL.
Say that again.
Yes, it's an IOC container.
Yeah.
That is customized to your domain.
Yeah.
Completely compiled in pure IL.
Right.
So.
Okay.
So basically, the idea. Actually, I was fascinated by Nick's description of AutoFac, and I think a couple episodes ago on your show.
Yep.
And he was talking about how, if you have a set of dependencies, they rarely ever change during the course of the lifetime of a particular container. Well, it turns out that when I just looked around at the other containers, I noticed that there was a huge bottleneck in terms of how they actually created their objects.
Because of reflection, and everything else that you've got to go through.
Reflection's one, but it turns out that with IOC containers, you're basically working with a very, very complex search algorithm. When somebody asks for an instance of a particular service,
mm-hmm.
what the container has to do is look at a type that implements that particular interface and then follow the constructor chain, or at least find the right constructor
that can actually create that type. To resolve any of its dependencies, etc.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the problem is that for a lot of the containers, there's a huge slowdown, because in some containers, like even Linfu, what I was doing is, once you come across a constructor, you see 5 parameters. You have to look up the dependencies for those 5 parameters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which might in turn have another 3 parameters off each one of them as well.
Yeah, and it blows up exponentially. In layman's terms, this is like if you were to go from point A to point B on some location on the map, and you were to stop at every single intersection and ask the person, where should I go next? And this is for every intersection from point A to point B. So yep. If you're traveling from one side of your country to the other, imagine how slow that would be.
Because Australia is a small country too.
Oh, small is a relative thing, but I mean, but now imagine if you had something like Google Maps, and then you said, all right, I just want to know what the path is to go from point A to point B.
Yep.
Give me all the possible directions and just tell me how to get there. So the difference with something like, say, Hero, which is another IOC container, is that it has zero lookups. I mean, if you look at the IL that it actually generates, it's this long chain of constructor calls. It's ridiculously fast, very fast.
So what's happening behind the scenes? When you compile your app with Hero as your container, you effectively do a second pass over the application again and then extrapolate all those all those constructor calls out to be one method with everything built into it? Or
the interesting part is I don't even touch your original DLL or your assembly. I basically look at all the possible instantiation paths in your assembly and generate a secondary assembly which contains the actual container that could create all the possible types in your assembly. So if you have a chain of concrete types that is like five levels deep, it looks at it and says, okay, this is based on the dependencies that I have currently mapped. I could pretty much create a constructor called chain that would actually create that particular instance. The other notable thing about Hero, even compared to, say, Linfu or even the other containers, is that it's conventions-based. There is practically no configuration code. There's no Fluent interface. It's basically, if you follow simple conventions, like if you have a constructor parameter with a given name and a given type, and that particular service type is available in the container, it's automatically injected through constructor injection. Or if you have a writable property that matches something inside of the configuration map, then that's basically gets injected too. So it's fascinating simply because of how simple it is. I mean, it's I'd even go as far as to say it's the anti-container because it's so small, and the feature set is very, very slim. Like, it only does two or three things. First is constructor injection. Third is second is property injection, and maybe the third one would probably be it's chainable, so or composable. So you could take these little containers and put them together. So it's a very simple container though, but so far I've had a few people tell me that it's incredibly fast.
So for the small to medium sized application, you'd probably be able to get away with using it for the features, because you're not really going to have a whole lot of complexity in those ones generally.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say it would cover about 80% of the cases where you don't really need anything fancy.
Yeah.
Check it out. I mean, it's a very, very small container. It's very fast. I mean, the benchmarks are pretty dramatic. It's at least about 200 or 300 times faster than any other container out there.
And we're talking, I suppose it's just a straight IO compile constructor call, isn't it? It's not going to be anything to it.
Yeah, I mean,
In terms of the speed, because you've already got everything there, so you don't have to do any lookups. It's just bang, there you go, object done.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically the container that you would write by hand if you were crazy enough to write it. Because I've seen the constructor call chains on some of these methods that it generates, and it's ridiculously crazy. I've seen cases where it goes out to about 2,300 constructor calls within one method, and that was just one dependency. So it inlines the code a lot. Needless to say, when I saw that, it really changed that whole argument about speed doesn't matter, because it made me realize that, okay, if this is doing this 2,300 times, what does it mean for your average container or your other containers that are actually doing this dynamically? I mean, that's a lot of performance there.
Yeah, absolutely. So where do we look for that one, just out of curiosity?
Hero is you could find that on GitHub.
Yep.
And I think it's under my name, so it's GitHub/ Philip Laureano.
Yep.
And I've got a few projects there. One of them is Hero. The other one is Linfu.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing quite a lot of things with at least Hero. I'm not Hero, but Linfu with language features. Because, I mean, like a lot of language geeks and IO geeks, I was quite disappointed to hear that Anders wasn't really happy with AOP and C# 5 or even C# 6. So at least guys like me and Gail are going to have a fun time within the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I was hoping something would turn up. I'm happy with the async stuff, by the way. I think that's great, but I was hoping for a bit more AOP to be showing up in the language soon.
Well, I think Gale was actually showing how it could be done with PostSharp. So, I mean, async's great, but I was kind of hoping for something more, because if you're going to – the whole dynamic keyword thing it was a good step, but I think it was a half-assed measure, because you basically you're exposing a dynamic an object that you can pretty much do whatever you want with it. But at the same time, Microsoft didn't really give us any facilities to make it useful, aside from the fact that, you know, they give us, well, like guys like me, the ability to extend it and make it really dynamic.
We're probably getting to time, so I should give you the opportunity to plug things. So if I want to know more about Linfu, where do I go? To your GitHub site?
You go to my GitHub site at github.com/PhilipLauriano. That's PhilipLauriano.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you have any questions, you could just contact me either through Twitter or my email address. My public email address is at martub@hotmail.com. So it's okay if you want to spam me. I have a massive spam filter called Hotmail. but I promise to be very, very prompt when it comes to my responses, as long as their requests are quite reasonable, and most of the time they are. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I have a very small code base, though, user base, but I'd say they're pretty loyal because I always treat them well. So if you have any questions, just ping me and I'll answer back.
Fantastic, fantastic. All right, so thanks, Philip, for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure.
As always. We'll have to get you back on to have a talk about some of this in more detail, because I don't think we had enough time, but... Yeah, very interesting stuff. Very interesting. And thank you, everyone. and thank you, everyone else, for listening, especially if you are listening to the live stream as well. And we will catch you on the next episode of Talking Shop Down Under. Until then, happy coding. Catch you later.